Sadvaitam Sadvaditam Parijana Sahita Chaitanya Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakam Pitamscha Vanchakalpa Jivischa Kripa Sindhi Vichap Tichanam Pavanevya Vaishnavya Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So it's April 6, 2019 in Auckland, New Zealand, and we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 15, Description of the Kingdom of God, Text 40. Pitam suke pratunitam bini visparantya. Kanshali bir virutaya vanamalaya cha. Valgu prakoshcha valayam vinata sutam se. Vinasta hasta mitarena dunanam abjam. Please check. Pita amshuke. Covered with a yellow cloth. Pritu nitambini. On his large hips. Visparantya. Shining brightly. Kancha, with a girdle. Alibihi, by the bees. Vichutaya, humming. Vanamalaya, with a garland of fresh flowers. What does vana literally mean?
Forest.
So like wildflowers. Not cultivated flowers, wildflowers. Cha, and valgu, lovely, prakoshta, wrists, valayam, bracelets, vinata sutta, a garuda, the son of vinata, amse, on the shoulder, vinyasta, rested, hastam, one hand, itarena, with another hand. Dunanam, being twirled. Abjam, a lotus flower. Srila Prabhupada's translation. He, the Supreme Lord Narayana, was adorned with a girdle that shone brightly on the yellow cloth covering his large hips. And he wore a garland of fresh flowers, which was distinguished by humming bees. His lovely wrists were graced with bracelets, and he rested one of his hands on the shoulder of Garuda, his carrier, and twirled a lotus with another hand. Srila Prabhupada's purport. Here's a full description of the personality of Godhead as personally experienced by the sages. The Lord's personal body was covered with yellow robes, and his waist was thin. In Vaikuntha, whenever there is a flower garland on the chest of the personality of Godhead, or any one of his associates, it is described that the humming bees are there. All these features were very beautiful and attractive for the devotees. One of the Lord's hands rested on his carrier, Garuda, and in another hand he twirled a lotus flower. These are personal characteristics of the personality of Godhead Narayana. Pitam shuke pratunitam vinisput vishpurantya kancha libir virutaya vanamalaya cha valgu prakosta valayam vinata sutam se vinyasta hasta mitarena dunanam abjam. He was adorned with a girdle that shone brightly on the yellow cloth covering his large hips, and he wore a garland of fresh flowers, which was distinguished by humming bees. His lovely wrists were graced with bracelets, and he rested one of his hands on the shoulder of Garuda, his carrier, and twirled a lotus with another hand. So we were reading yesterday about how affectionate the Lord is to everyone, to the impersonalists, to the devotees, to the offended, and to the offenders. And here we see his affection to Garuda. So at the present time, generally our carriers are cars, yeah? As actually thinking about this, I think it was when I was in Malaysia, I can't remember where I was, but anyway, I was driving down the street in a car, and there's also, you know, motorcycles, and I was just thinking how odd it is that human beings were being transported by these mechanized wheeled vehicles. You know, just actually thinking about it, you know, having grown up all my life with cars and bicycles and motorcycles, I realized I had just taken it for granted. But, you know, if someone came from a place where people were just walking or going by animals, and all of a sudden they saw that human beings were being transported by these mechanized wheels, they would think, well, that's kind of an odd way to get from one place to the other. So sometimes people have a lot of affection for their motorized wheeled vehicles, right? Sometimes you see people there cleaning their car, almost like it's a living entity. And in fact, in English, it's interesting, we don't have gendered nouns, but sometimes we do. And the times that we refer to nouns with a gender, it's almost always female and it's almost always vehicles. Right? Ships and boats and planes and cars are she. So people are thinking, you know, some affectionate relationship with their vehicle. So in former times when people were going around with horses and oxen, they actually did have a relationship because their vehicle was a living entity. Of course, sometimes it wasn't a nice relationship. Sometimes they were mistreating their vehicle. But one of my... I should actually back up a little bit. So in the Gurukula, we needed to give the kids things to read, and we didn't have enough Krishna conscious books. Like now we've published this Krishna conscious novel. It's not for children though, it's for adults and teenagers. But anyway, we didn't have enough reading material, and so we'd have to get books written by other than Hare Krishna devotees, which I gradually saw had some benefits to it as well. But anyway, I would go in America, there's a lot of Christian publishers who publish, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of books. America is the most religious of all of the democratic countries. And so there's tons and tons of Christian books, academic books, reading books. Anyway, so I ended up getting this, one of my favorite books that I got from a Christian author. Part of the story in it was this young, very arrogant prince whose evil uncle had usurped the kingdom. And he knew that he was the rightful king, but he wasn't able to get his kingdom. So he was taken on, he was mentored and taken on as a student, as a protege, by a friend of his deceased father who taught him how to be a real king. And this young prince had never learned how to ride a horse because his evil uncle didn't want him to learn any of the arts of royalty. So he had never ridden on a horse. But his mentor took him on a horse and took him out to show him other kingdoms and show him the world and teach him about life and teach him how to rule. So after his first day of very difficult riding, because he'd never ridden on a horse before, so he gets off the horse at the end of the day and he's exhausted. And as he gets off the horse, he just, you know, goes to get some dinner. And his mentor says to him, "First the horse." So always remember that. First take care of your horse. Take his saddle off, take his blanket off, brush him down, give him water, give him food. Make sure you may be the prince, doesn't matter. Even if you're the prince, first your horse, then yourself. So here we see Krishna is so affectionate to his carrier. He's not treating his carrier just as some sort of a slave, you know, or some sort of a machine. He's very affectionately resting his hand on the shoulder of Garuda. Sometimes we think, often actually we think, that, well, I'm a little scared to surrender to Krishna because if I surrender to Krishna, how will he treat me? We look at our unsurrendered or partially surrendered life in the material world, and we see that we don't always have the kind of life that we want, isn't it? Right? And we think, well, if there's a kind God, why do I get sick? Or why don't I have enough money? Or why can't I find a suitable spouse? Or whatever it is that's bothering us in our life. And we think, well, if I really fully, you know, now I'm partially surrendered to Krishna, so I'm still kind of controlling my life. But if I fully surrendered to Krishna, who knows what would happen to me? Right? I might get exiled like the Pandavas. And, right? So many things. But here we have this assurance that Krishna is full of affection for his servants. Actually, I was just hearing Prabhupada say this morning how Krishna is very kind to everyone, and Krishna takes great pleasure in fulfilling the desires of everyone. Prabhupada was saying for the pure devotees, he fulfills their desires immediately. He said for the demons, they have to earn it through their karma. But still, Krishna takes great pleasure in fulfilling everyone's desires. Eko bahunam yo vidadanti kaman. Anyway, here we see that he has this affectionate relationship. And when Prahlad Maharaj saw Lord Nrisingadeva, and Lord Nrisingadeva put his hand on Prahlad's head, Prahlad was saying, this is a great favor you're showing me by touching me with your hand. As if we can just imagine for a minute, so if the Lord was taking his very soft lotus hand that's full of benedictions and putting it on us, placing it with affection on our shoulder, on our head, how wonderful it would feel. So I thought I'd take the opportunity today to do some little meditation on Garuda. I mean, I was struck here by several things. We have the Lord's cloth, we have this garland, we have the bees around his garland. Generally, you don't have bees around a garland because the flowers are no longer on the plant. Yes, the bees are would be on a garland only if the garland was, the flowers were still alive. So that's indicative of the nature of the spiritual world. And I also thought about talking about the lotus flower, but I don't know if we'll have time to talk about anybody except for Garuda. So next time you go through the Bhagavatam and you come to this verse, then maybe you could talk about one of the other things. So looking at Garuda, so I was thinking of the pastimes in the Bhagavatam that where Garuda is involved. And the first one I thought of is how Krishna goes on the back of Garuda with his wife, Satyabhama, when they go to kill Bhomasura. And Bhomasura is actually Krishna's son. Bhomasura is the son of Varaha and Bhumi. So when Varaha lifted Bhumi out of the earth, he also impregnated her, which is kind of interesting to meditate on. And she became pregnant with Bhoma. Unfortunately, Bhoma had some bad associations. So even if you're the son of God, you can end up in trouble. So he ended up with some bad association, and he kidnapped these 16,100 women. One would assume that he raped them also. And he was keeping them in this, in a kind of a nice prison that he was. So he became very demoniac. But he'd also stolen some of the paraphernalia of the demigods. He'd stolen the earrings and I think the umbrella of Aditi, the mother of the demigods. And the demigods were very anxious to get them back. Now, you might wonder, why are the demigods so interested in umbrella and earrings? Yeah, I mean, okay. If I lose some earrings that I like, I might want them back. But I don't think I'd go to war for them, huh? I mean, that's a little extreme. I mean, and even you could say, well, maybe they were particularly valuable or they had some sentimental value. But even then, I don't think one's going to go through a war for earrings. And one devotee was nicely explaining to me, just like we have paraphernalia that give us a kind of mystic power, right? So I would assume that all of you have a phone. So your phone gives you all kinds of mystic powers. You can go on Amazon and you click one button, and all of a sudden, the package shows up at your door. Have you all tried this? Prapti Siddhi, right, through your phone? Or if you get an electronic book, you push a button on your phone, and 2 seconds later, the electronic book is on your phone. The first time I did that, I was so thrilled by it that I wanted to buy another book just to see it happen again. I thought, very good marketing technique. But this is our, you know, Kali Yuga version of Prapti Siddhi. Or, you know, through my phone, I can have a video call with somebody in America. That's another kind of mystic power, right? It's kind of like having telepathy. All of a sudden, I can connect with someone in another part of the world. So I have these devices that extend my powers, correct? So therefore, I'm attached to them. I'm not attached to my phone because it's a piece of metal and plastic. And it's really pretty, you know. Oh, look what a pretty phone I have. I'm attached to it because it gives me some kind of powers. So the demigods have this paraphernalia that extend their powers. I was just reading a purport in the fourth canto about how the demigods are often worshipped through their particular weapons. You know, so they have this paraphernalia, they have these weapons that give them power. Of course, it gives them very subtle powers. They're not operating so much on the gross platform like our paraphernalia in the Kali Yuga. But anyway, therefore, they're attached to these things. You know, these things that are imbued with power. We read this often in the battles between the demigods and the demons, how they have these subtle weapons, right? These objects, but they have all kinds of subtle power. So therefore, Indra asked Krishna to get these back for his mother. Now, if you think about this, though, riding on the back of Garuda, you know, I don't know if I should say this or not, but anyway, when I was 16, some guy took me on the back of a motorcycle, and it was like, whoa! But imagine flying with your husband on the back of Garuda. It'd be a lot more exciting than traveling with some ordinary guy on the back of a motorcycle. The only time I travel on the back of a motorcycle now is in India, and it's not very exciting. It's actually just kind of awful. It's like, oh my God, am I going to die? I better chant Hare Krishna really nicely. But imagine that, you know, riding on the back of this gigantic eagle with your husband. How exciting that would be. So Krishna is all full of adventures. Of course, Krishna rides on the back of Garuda, not only just on this planet from one place to another, but also through the universe. You know, when we want to go through the universe, we have to make a mechanical spaceship. And it's not very pleasant. Right? The astronauts who are in the mechanical spaceship, their bone density decreases. They get all kinds of health problems from being in this weightless atmosphere. Right? And if they want to go into outer space without a vehicle, they have to have these huge suits that are tethered by an umbilical cord back to the ship. There was recently this whole brouhaha in America that they were hoping to have a spacewalk with two women astronauts, but they didn't have the right size suit. So it had to be one man and one woman because they didn't have the right size suit for the two women. And so everybody was joking about that NASA didn't have a full wardrobe. But these suits that they go out in, the astronauts were describing that they're like armor. You know, it's not like you put on a winter coat or something like that. There's completely stiff armor to go in this atmosphere, right? This big helmet, so that you don't get killed by the lack of air pressure and the lack of oxygen and the freezing cold and so many things. But Krishna is just out there. You know, he doesn't have a spacesuit flying through outer space. He's just standing on the back of Garuda. And Garuda doesn't need a spacesuit either. You know, they're just flying through outer space because they don't have material bodies. I mean, although it describes that the Lord breathes, when Mahavishnu breathes, he breathes out the universes. And it says that in the Bhagavatam that the tides, this is a very nice place to meditate on this, the tides are the breathing of who? Whose breathing do you see in the tides? Hmm? That was a wonderful guess, but no. Huh? Anantasesha, another wonderful guess, but no. Hey, come on, all of you people living here in Auckland. This is one of your easiest meditations on the Lord. Right? When I stayed for months here, I really kind of got in sync with the tides. Well, you're right by this tidal estuary. And so you're really, really aware of the tides. Hmm? Varuna Day. Ah, another good guess. Well, yes, Krishna, but what incarnation? Okay, I'll give you a little hint. It's an incarnation that goes in liquid. Very close. Very, very close. And you notice I said liquid, not water. Kurma. So the Bhagavatam says that the tides are the breathing of kurma, that when the tides are going in and the tides are going out, this is the breathing of kurma. So when you're walking on the property and you see the tidal estuary and you see it fills up, right? And then it becomes almost dry. Again, it fills up. And each day it's shifting by an hour. Fills up, dries up twice a day, and each time by an hour. That's the breathing of kurma. Anyway, so when the story is that the demigods had been defeated by the demons, and so they went to the Lord and they said, "My dear Lord, we've been defeated by the demons." He said, "Well, sometimes you fight with your enemies and sometimes you cut a deal. I suggest this time you cut a deal. Tell the demons that we can get immortal nectar out of the ocean of milk. Just like if you take ordinary milk, if it has a lot of cream in it, and you churn it, you get butter. Right? Even I've been to a devotee farm with a bunch of kids, and they'll do an exercise where they put cream in a glass jar, and you shake the jar, and you get a ball of butter. Then you take the butter, and you heat it, and you get ghee. So from the milk, you ultimately get ghee. So by churning the milk ocean, you could get this nectar. And this nectar is not like we have nectar drink at the Sunday feast. It's not quite like that. It's a nectar that as long as you keep drinking it, you won't die. You won't get sick, you won't die, and you'll be full of health and vitality. You know, you can go to a health food store today and you can get some pill or some liquid or something that will promise you to do this kind of thing. But I don't think it's quite like the demigod's nectar. So they were going to get this nectar from the ocean of milk. And the demigod said, "We can't do it alone. We need your help. And then, you know, we'll share the nectar." So the demons were very enthusiastic that they would get this nectar because, you know, they were each thinking, if we get this nectar, we'll be able to defeat each other. So it was kind of a funny truce. The demigods are thinking, if we get the nectar, we'll be able to defeat the demons. And the demons are thinking, if we get the nectar, we'll be able to defeat the demigods. This is the nature of agreements in this world many times. You know, friendships and business agreements. That it's, yes, yes, I'm agreeing with you, you're agreeing with me, but my purpose is to take something from you and your purpose is to take something from me. So then they said to the demons, "We have to take the Mandara mountain and take it to the ocean of milk to use it as a churning rod." So Lord Vishnu accompanied them while they're carrying the Mandara mountain, and he's on the back of Garuda. Generally, the Lord doesn't sit on Garuda, he stands. So he's usually standing on the back of Garuda. Just again, imagine that, you know, standing on this huge eagle flying through outer space. Yes. So the Lord accompanies them, and at one point they drop the mountain and it crushes them, and then he restores them to health, and then he personally carries the mountain. So they bring the mountain to the ocean of milk, put this churning rod, put the mountain in the ocean of milk, and then they have to have some kind of rope to churn the churning rod. Right? The ocean of milk was too big to put in a glass jar. So they had to have a churning pot, which was the basin of the ocean itself. So they had this churning rod, but you have to pull the churning rod. So they needed a rope. So Lord Vishnu called for the king of snakes, Vasuki, to be the rope. So Vasuki came, wrapped himself around the mountain. But Garuda was there. So Vasuki was a little hesitant Because Garuda, although he's a pure devotee of the Lord, he's not a vegetarian. So generally we think of vegetarianism as being an absolute requirement for being a devotee of the Lord, but we have at least one non-vegetarian pure devotee. I don't know if there's others, but we have at least this one, Garuda. And Garuda particularly likes to eat snakes. So because the snake was Garuda's natural food, therefore Lord Vishnu said to Garuda, I think you'd better go. And Garuda left, and then the Lord sat on top of the mountain. Then when the mountain started to sink, he came as Korma under the mountain to hold up the mountain. And as the mountain was turning, it was scratching Korma's back. And just like sometimes, not ever back scratched. And it was also polishing his jewelry. So like we polish the Lord's jewelry in cups, right? So the moving of the mountain was polishing Korma's jewelry. Now it's very interesting how the Lord dismissed Garuda. We were talking about this yesterday at breakfast, that sometimes we think that we have to be intimate friends with all the devotees all the time. You know, there was this one astrologer who said Prabhupada was building a house in which the whole world could live. But I don't know about your houses, but most houses I've seen have more than one room. Yes? And although I'm staying in a house, right, staying at Arjuna and Madhava Sangini's house, it's a separate building. So they have their life in their house, and I have my life in my little house, but it's really part of the same house. So it's also even like that for the pure devotees. It's not that all the pure devotees are good friends with all the other pure devotees. That's just not true. There's no malice. Nobody ever harms anyone else. And everyone appreciates that everyone else is a devotee. But they don't all appreciate exactly the way everyone else does service. In the first canto, Prabhupada says, Akura and his father-in-law were both pure devotees, but they didn't get along. And I remember when I first read that, when I was very new in Krishna consciousness, I couldn't really make heads or tails out of it. I'm like, huh? How is it if they're both pure devotees, they don't really get along? So this is something very mysterious that is really brought up in this particular story of Garuda and Vasuki. You know, Srila Prabhupada talks about how we each have a different center of interest, generally ourselves, sometimes our families, our countries, or whatever, extended self. And because we have different centers of interest, therefore we have conflict with one another. And he compares it to rocks thrown into a pond in different places that have circles that come out from them, and the circles conflict with one another. But if all the rocks are thrown into the same place, then the circles are all concentric and there's no conflict. So if all of us are simply trying to satisfy Krishna, then we don't have conflict like we have in the material world. At the same time, we are all individuals. And because we're individuals, we have different ways that we want to serve Krishna. Krishna has an infinite number of desires. I was speaking with one devotee who told me that his Guru Maharaj said to him, Krishna has an infinite number of desires. You can pick any of them that you want to satisfy. And there's an infinite number of jivas, and each of us connects with some of the Lord's desires. But the Lord has different desires, and some of those desires may appear to be opposite from one another. Even we're like that, right? Sometimes we want to be with other people, no matter how introverted a person is. Sometimes they like to be with other people, at least one or two other people. And now, no matter how extroverted a person is, sometimes they would like some quiet. Isn't that a fact? Right? I was at one devotee community where they were keeping me particularly busy. This program, that program, this program, that program. And finally I got back to where I was staying, and one of the ladies follows me, and I was staying in a devotee's house, but I was staying in a room there, and I start to go into the room where I was staying, and she says, what service can I do for you? I said, you can leave me alone. And she says, no, I want to do some service for you. I said, you can just leave me alone. I need some alone time. I had to say it about 5 times before she actually understood that leaving me alone would be a service. So Krishna also wants different things at different times, and he has different moods. And devotees, you know, who serve him in one mood may not really understand the devotees who serve him in another mood. Like Rupa Goswami so nicely explains in Ujjwala Nilamani, that the two main competing groups of gopis, Radharani's group and Chandravali's group, they do appreciate each other's service. It's not that they don't appreciate each other's service. Sometimes, in fact, they really glorify each other. Like when Krishna takes Radharani away from the Ras dance, and there's that verse, oh, this gopi has served Krishna the best. That's where Radha's name is indirectly mentioned, Aradhana. Acharyas say that it's Radharani's chief rival, Chandravali, who says this verse. So sometimes they appreciate one another. Kavi Kanapur describes how Radharani and Chandravali and Lalita are all serving the Lord together. And some pastimes are all together. But sometimes they don't. You know, Radharani is saying, this Chandravali, when Krishna does something wrong, she immediately forgives him. She's just soft with him. He doesn't like that. He likes his girls to be feisty and argumentative. She's not serving him properly. I don't like the way she serves him. And Chandravali is saying, this Radharani, when Krishna offends her, and then he says he's sorry and he falls at her feet, and Radharani's footlack is getting on his forehead, still she doesn't forgive him. I don't like the way this Radharani treats him. So among the pure devotees, they may say, you know, the way this devotee is serving Krishna, I don't like that. Krishna doesn't like that. Krishna likes the way I serve. Krishna doesn't like the way this devotee serves. But the center is still Krishna and pleasing Krishna. Therefore, there's no malice. But because different devotees have different moods in service, to please Krishna with his different desires, they can't all serve together all the time. Does that make sense to everyone? You know, some cowherd boys, they like to insult Krishna in a joking way, like we sometimes do with our friends. But other cowherd boys, they're very submissive. And the cowherd boys are very submissive when they hear these other cowherd boys insulting Krishna. They feel awkward. They're like, how do you talk to Krishna like that? But there's no malice. No one's committing an offense. No one's anybody's enemy. So here, Garuda understands that, you know, Vasuki and I are not going to be able to be in the same lila. We're not at the same time. Garuda's in the lila to bring Lord Vishnu there. But as soon as Vasuki shows up as the rope, okay, then Garuda leaves. So in our own life also, you know, there's times that other devotees should be pushed forward. Yes, this is your service. You do your service. Like Prabhupada said, that if you have centralization and bureaucracy, it ruins the whole movement. That devotional service should be individual, spontaneous, and voluntary. He said, we want to have people who are independently thoughtful. And right after that, he says, forget this centralization and bureaucracy. Centralization and bureaucracy means there's, you know, one person or one group of people at the center and they tell everybody else how to do things all the time. You know, as someone said to me yesterday, if I want your opinion, I'll give it to you. So it's not like that. We need to be, if we want to enter into Vaikuntha, it's up to us. It's just hearing Prabhupada say this morning, it's up to us what we want to do. But if we want to enter into Vaikuntha, then that entails an appreciation for a devotee whose mood of service and type of service may be diametrically opposed to ours, and with whom we cannot possibly work for any length of time because we have such a different viewpoint of service. And to appreciate that devotee and to facilitate that devotee. Not just to facilitate the devotees who want to serve Krishna in the same way that I want to serve Krishna. The time that I was in a community that was the most healthy was when there were two competing temples and two competing gurukul schools. And it was really interesting because when devotees wanted to start a competing school, actually first the devotees wanted my husband and I to take into the school a particular devotee educator who had a very different view of education than I had. And I talked to this devotee and I could understand immediately that there was no way that we could both be in the same school. I said, this person is my peer, he's my godbrother, he's as old as I am, he's as educated as I am, that there's no way I'm going to be in charge of him and there's no way he's going to be in charge of me. That's not going to happen. We'd have to work as equals. And his view of education and my view of education was just very, very different in some key areas. And I said, you know, it's just not going to work. And people were saying, it has to. Prabhupada wants us to cooperate. And it was interesting. My husband was the only one in the whole community who was saying he should start his own school. And everybody was just, oh, that's all Maya. Everybody has to do everything together all the time. Anyway, he started his own school. And as soon as he started his own school, they also started their own temple. The people who were working with him to start their own school also started their own temple. And what happened very, very quickly is any political agitation in the community went down to about zero. People's criticism of each other went down to about zero. People's enthusiasm for their service exploded. And the whole community grew by 3 times. And I looked at that and thought, well, that's really interesting. And of course, if we make the whole world Krishna conscious, you know, or let's just say Auckland, if the world's kind of a little too big for us to think about, or maybe just the North Island, or maybe just New Zealand, how many temples and schools would we have? I mean, how many temples and schools would we need to have in Auckland if all of Auckland was in Lord Chaitanya's movement? A lot. And believe me, they'd have different moods. But if Krishna's the center and everyone's trying to please Krishna, then it's our duty to appreciate him. I've been in some communities where there's more than one school and people don't appreciate each other. Well, our school is the only real Krishna conscious school, and that's in Maya school. I've seen that kind of thing. To see there's room for so many different efforts and attempts. Prabhupada says that Krishna consciousness is not narrow or stereotyped. Now then there's another pastime with Garuda that's in contrast to this one. This is described in Bhagavatam 3:19-14. So here we have Garuda described as Vinata Suta. He's the son of Vinata and Kasyapa. So Kasyapa had 4 wives and another one was Kadru. So Vinata was the mother of Garuda and Kadru was the mother of the snakes. So this was a problem. We have a number of places in the Bhagavatam where step-parents are a problem, particularly step-mothers. Step-mothers really have a bad rap in the world. And, you know, all of anyone who's listening to this class right now or later on the recording, I'm sure you can be a good step-mother too. There's also examples in the Shastra of very loving and wonderful step-mothers. In fact, the majority of examples in the Shastra of stepmothers are those who are loving and caring toward their stepchildren and who get along with the other mother and so forth. So it's not that just being a stepmother condemns you to be nasty. But certainly there are examples like this. And there are examples also, we have Hiranyakashipu and Prahlad, father and child. So we're the most surprised when there's some difficulty between family members, isn't it? Right, we expect the family, they're always going to be there for you. But because Kadru was the mother of the snakes and Vinita was the mother of Garuda, they had this enmity because their children were natural enemies. The snakes were Garuda's food. You know, so if your stepson was going to eat your children, there might be some difficulty there. So at one point, Kadru actually captured Vinita. And Garuda needed to release her. And in order to release her, he needed some nectar. I don't know exactly in which way Kadru kidnapped or confined or did something to Vinata, for which he needed nectar to be released. That, I don't know that whole description. I'm sure it's in another Purana. So to get the nectar, you know, if your mother's in trouble, you may not be very careful about how you get what you need to help her out. Isn't it? So Indra had some nectar, and Garuda just took it from him. Sometimes it's said that Garuda took the nectar from the mouth of Indra. Sometimes it's said he snatched a pot of nectar from Indra. So Indra didn't appreciate that, and Indra threw his weapon at Garuda, and Garuda allowed that weapon to cut off one of his wings. But he did bring the nectar to his mother and released his mother, and hopefully the family got along okay after that. So some interesting things there. Here we see a competition that was malicious. So in comparison to the different moods in serving Krishna, that all have the same center, where there's no malice, there's no hatred. You're not trying to destroy the other person's service, even though it's radically different from yours, or even diametrically opposed to yours. Because you know if anyone's trying to please Krishna, that's glorious, even if they're trying to please Krishna in an opposite way to yours. So there's a loving competition to please Krishna. But here we see between Vinata and Kadru, there was a malicious competition. So there's quite a difference. It's not that impersonally we get rid of competition, but we make it loving. But we also see the mood of Garuda toward Indra, who's also a devotee. Although he took the nectar from Indra for the sake of his mother, he wanted to honor Indra's weapon. He didn't want to have this mood, well, I'm Garuda. Who do you think you are to cut off my wing, to attack me? He said, sure, Indra, if you want to attack me, fine. I will allow you to attack me. This is the essence of the Trinadapi verse. You know, if we're dealing with another devotee or anyone who deals with us harshly, we say, okay, fine, as you like. I mean, of course, we have some duty to this body and mind. If, you know, someone's trying to kill you or rape you, you don't just stand there and let it happen if you can run away. But here, Indra's showing respect, fine. If you think that because I've taken the nectar that you should attack me, I accept that. You know, generally as conditioned souls, we're always trying to defend ourselves. You know, Garuda could have said, it was for my mother! And you're supposed to be a devotee. You should be helping me serve my mother. What's wrong with you? But he didn't. He said, fine. I accept if you want to chastise me. So a number of other times in the Bhagavatam that the Lord is riding on Garuda to visit people. Can any of you think of some of those times? What persons did the Lord come to see riding on the back of Garuda? Gajendra, yes. Mahavishnu. We went in a chariot. Maybe there's another story, but the one I'm thinking of, the one in a chariot. The horses got really scared when they got to the effulgence outside the universe and when they came to the darkness of the covering of the universe. Yeah, that we talked about in the beginning. Were you late? I was wondering, either did I tell that story very poorly? Or did you miss it? If I told it poorly, then I always grade myself as a teacher. When else was Krishna on the back, or Vishnu on the back of Garuda in the Bhagavatam? Yeah? Fighting with Banasura. You know, I'm not sure about that one. Visit Dhruva, yes? Yes, Prabhu? When he visited Prithu Maharaj for the sacrifice. What's interesting about that one, again, the Lord was resting his hand on Garuda's shoulder, just like he's doing here. And in that case, when he visited Prithu, his feet touched the ground. Generally, Lord Vishnu's feet don't touch the ground when he comes to earth. But in that time, out of respect for Prithu, his feet touched the ground. And that actually reminds me of a story about, of some stories about Srila Prabhupada. So, the first time that I was meeting with Prabhupada in his room, he was sitting with his right leg up and his dhoti was around his knee, and you could see his right calf and right foot and his left foot. You could see the bottoms of his feet. And I remember thinking at the time, his skin looks like a baby's skin. You know, generally, that's not the case. As we age, our body, our skin no longer looks like that of a baby. And I just simply noted that with sort of astonishment. But I didn't think about it deeply until very, very recently. So it was a few months ago that I was staying at Govardhan. It was regularly, I generally take long walks every day. And it's very dry there, very sandy. And so my feet were getting cracked and dry, right? I was having to scrub them. And all of a sudden I thought, wait a minute. Prabhupada took an hour and a half brisk walk every day. Now, if you're walking for an hour and a half every day very fast, your feet are going to get cracked and calloused. They just are. There's going to be the movement against your shoes. Yes? It's physically impossible to take a long, fast walk every day and have your feet look like that. So then I contacted my son-in-law's father, Shri Kirti, and I said, you massage Prabhupada every day. Did he have any hard spots or cracks on his feet? He said, no, not a one ever. He said his feet were just completely soft. What's going on here? How is that possible? And then I remembered a story one of my god sisters told, that she was with Prabhupada in England, where, like here, it rains a lot. And it was a very muddy morning. The devotees were out walking, the ground was muddy, and when they came back, all their shoes were muddy. And she thought, I will clean the mud off of Prabhupada's shoes. But when she looked at Prabhupada's shoes, they didn't have a speck of mud on them. I told these stories to a devotee who told me that when he was in Australia with Prabhupada, he remembered the pastime with Lord Chaitanya, where as Lord Chaitanya was walking, that devotees were digging up the dirt where he had stepped. And so there were these deep holes wherever Lord Chaitanya's footprint has been, because they wanted to get the dust that he had touched with his feet. And he said that he was determined to do that with Srila Prabhupada. So he went on the morning walk and he's following behind Prabhupada, but there were no impressions. Then I was talking to another devotee who told me that he had an experience with Prabhupada on a morning walk. Whereas Prabhupada was about to step, he saw that there was a slug or an earthworm or something. And he thought, oh no, Prabhupada's going to kill it. And he was too late to tell Prabhupada. Prabhupada put his foot down, and when he lifted his foot up, the creature was completely fine. And again, there was no impression of Prabhupada's feet. So you may draw your own conclusions from that. So when else did the Lord go on the back of Garuda? Any other person that he visited? Gajendra, we said. The Prachetas, Daksha. Well, that was part of the same Leela. And I didn't tell that part of the Leela. I just talked about how they went to fight with Bhomasura. But yeah, after they fought with Bhomasura, when they brought back those valuable earrings and umbrella back to Aditi, then, you know, Satyabhama wanted a flower like Rukmini had, and Krishna gave her the whole tree. So yeah, they were carrying the whole Parijata tree on the back of Garuda back to the earth planet. While they were bad, first he had a battle with Indra. So you know, Satyabhama is, she's sitting on the back of Garuda, or standing, I don't know, sitting or standing, while Krishna's fighting, having this battle with Bulmasura. And then again, she's on the back of Garuda while they're carrying this Parijata tree and battling with Indra. Must have been pretty exciting. Right? Better than any Hollywood movie of interstellar battles. And of course, we have another story of respect with Sabari Muni, where Garuda wouldn't enter the water because Sabari Muni had cursed him, not because he thought the curse was effective, but out of respect. But the last thing I want to mention about, well, a couple things. One is that Garuda's wings also sing. Like Krishna can do anything with any of his senses, so can the liberated souls. And Garuda's wings sing the Vedas, so as he flies, his wing, especially the Samaveda, but they can sing any prayers. So you just... Would that be cool if you could sing with your hands? Wouldn't that be cool? Maybe you could harmonize with your voice. So like if you're making something in the kitchen and your hands would be singing as you were making it, and then your voice could be singing, you could be a whole orchestra. I don't know how that works. So... When Bali Maharaj promised Vamandev 3 steps of land, he only gave Vamandev how many steps?
2.
So the Bali's demons attacked the Lord, and Garuda was fighting with those demons. He was also there, was fighting with the demons. And then it was Garuda who tied up Bali. So we often say Vamana arrested Bali, but it was actually Garuda who tied up Bali with the ropes of Garuda. So Garuda's also, you know, like if you go into battle with a war horse, the horse also fights. The horse also rears up and fights. So Garuda also fights with his talons and beak and so forth in the battle, while the Lord is riding on the back of him. And just like I saw these girls doing horseback riding. So when you're horseback riding, you have a saddle, yeah, and stirrups. But the Lord doesn't have any saddle. He's just standing on the back of Garuda. He's not even sitting generally, he's standing. And Garuda's fighting, and he's fighting. And sometimes he has his wife with him carrying a tree. Oh, he's fighting. So these are the glories of the Lord's devotees, and the Lord has this great affection to Garuda. So he's coming out of the gates of Vaikuntha to see the doorkeepers and the sages, and he's not about to go flying anywhere. But it's still Garuda comes with him. And the Lord is there with this very affectionate relationship with Garuda. So we all also have some affectionate relationship with the Lord. We all also have our own activities and pastimes with the Lord. And he's a relationship of deep affection with us. And he likes to hear the stories of just like we may talk to somebody about, we did this and we did that. So I'm sure that the Lord talks to Garuda, hey, you remember when we were fighting there? Oh, can you imagine that? I mean, we gave Indra his mother's earrings. And yeah, it was ridiculous. You were even carrying that tree, my dear Lord. Yes, and you were attacking. So, we also have such conversations with him. So by meditating on the form of the Lord and his devotees, his activities, we also gradually enter into his pastimes. As I say, next time you cycle through the Bhagavatam, you can ask people to talk about the bees or the lotus flowers. We could have talked about Garuda for another week, so. Just a few minutes if anyone has questions or comments. Sorry, I talked about Garuda for too long. I went over the time. Yes?
You talked about having fear of Krishna. How can we overcome that?
How do we overcome the fear that Krishna is not going to be affectionate with us and take care of us nicely? By trusting him a little bit and seeing that it works out, and then trusting him a little bit more. Do you guys ever go ice skating here? Can you? It probably doesn't get cold enough to do that here. You have to go south, right? But if you ever go ice skating on a natural lake, a natural pond, so, you know, you may just before, when you first go there, when it freezes, you just may step on the edge of the pond, see if it holds you, you know. Or you may throw a rock onto the pond. And you gradually go more and more, and as you see that it's holding, then you go get your ice skates and skate all over the pond. So generally, our faith builds gradually. In fact, one can say the whole process from Shraddha to Prema is a gradual increase of faith. Okay, so what are these things that Krishna is taking away?
Attachments.
He's taking away the causes of our suffering. Just like sometimes you meet a person who finds out that they have some sort of allergy or some food intolerance. I've met people who, you know, they had some sickness for decades sometimes. And then they just find out that there's a certain kind of food they can't eat, that it makes them sick. And when that food is removed from their diet, then they feel very healthy and happy. Now, previously they might have been attached to that food because maybe it tasted good. But once they discover that that food is causing them sickness and the doctor removes that food from their diet, they're very happy. I mean, they're like extremely happy. So that's what Krishna takes away. Krishna only takes away the things that are making us ill. Now, we might not realize it making us ill. So at the point that he takes them away, we may be objecting. But we see very quickly, oh, what a relief. And sometimes it takes a while. I mean, I had something Krishna took away from me that it took me 15 years to understand that it was a blessing. But gradually you start seeing, hey, those were all blessings. They were all blessings. They actually losing, you know, you don't just get joy and peace and happiness by getting things. Otherwise, our houses would be, you know, that's like hoarders. If you've ever been to the home of a hoarder. I know somebody who's a hoarder. You can't walk in her house. Anything that's ever come in the post, she's kept. Imagine that. Or I know someone else whose desk is a big pile. There's a big hill on his desk. And one time, you know, his wife was saying, why don't we go through your desk? So the three of us went through this. There were unopened envelopes there that were 4 years old from the postage stamp. The guy couldn't use his desk. But he was objecting, saying, no, we don't have to go through my desk. We don't have to go through. And then he had a clean desk and he could find his things, you know. He had bills he wasn't paying on time and things he would have liked to have take advantage of that he didn't know about on time. So we also get happy by getting rid of things. Haven't you ever been happy? Who's ever been happy by getting rid of something? We don't only become happy by gaining things. It's like, oh, I finally got rid of that thing. Right? Sometimes it's even a person. Sometimes it's a relief, you know. Like when I was running a school, we had this one student who was superficially very pleasant, but who was causing a huge problem in the school. Because she was superficially pleasant, I didn't have any grounds to get rid of her. But I knew it was her. Because one time she got strep throat and was out of school for a week and the whole school changed. So I knew it was her. But I couldn't do anything about it. And then her family moved. Yeah. Sometimes we become happy and peaceful and free by having a person leave our life. Or a thing. Or a behavior. Haven't each of us been happy when we've jettisoned some behavior from our life? Yes? Who's here ever become happy by getting rid of a particular behavior or habit? And if somebody helps you get rid of that behavior, aren't you grateful to them? You might not be at first. I like my TV show. I like my cup of whiskey in the evening. You know, you at first you might be like, bah. And then you're like, oh, my life is so much better now that I'm not watching that stupid show. Isn't it? And then you feel grateful to the person. So what's the everything Krishna takes away? He only takes away everything of the everythings that's causing you pain. And sometimes we're so used to these things that we don't even realize that we don't need them. You know, if you've been carrying a heavy backpack on your shoulders for hours and hours and hours and hours, you may actually forget that what life is like without it. And he takes it, and someone takes it up. Oh, God, can I carry that for you for a while? No, no, it's okay, I'm doing fine, And then they take it, you're like, wow. So yeah, like that. Is that right? Often in the moment we don't appreciate it. Often in the moment we're like, but I wanted that. It's familiar. You do that with your kids too, right? It's time to eat. And they're playing with something. And sometimes you may actually go and physically take the toy out of their hands. Don't you ever do that? And put it up on a high shelf, it's time to eat. And then once they eat, they're happy. Yes? So thank you very much.